think about rotation," said the medical lama. My guide apparently did so, for the cylinder started to rotate again. It was quite impossible for my guide or for anyone else to have blown on the cylinder and made it rotate because of the glass. He stopped the cylinder again and then turned to me and said, "You try it, Lobsang." He rose from his seat and I took his place. I sat down and placed my hands just as had my guide. The medical lama Chinrob Nobo held the sheet of glass in front of me so that my breath would not influence the rotation of the cylinder. I sat there feeling like a fool. Apparently the cylinder thought I was one too, for nothing happened. "Think of making it rotate, Lobsang," said my guide. I did so, and immediately the thing started to go round. For a moment I felt like dropping everything and running. I thought the thing was bewitched, then reason, of a sort, prevailed and I just sat still. "That device, Lobsang," said my guide, "runs by the force of the human aura. You think of rotating it and your aura puts a swirl on the thing which causes it to turn. You may be interested to know that a device such as this has been experimented with in all the greater countries of the world. All the greatest scientists have tried to explain away the workings of this thing, but Western people, of course, cannot believe in etheric force and so they invent explanations which are even stranger than the actual force of the etheric." The great medical lama said, "I am feeling quite hungry, Minya donned up. I feel that it is time we repair to our rooms for a rest and for sustenance. We must not tax the young man's abilities nor his endurance, for he will get enough of that in the future." We turned, and the lights were extinguished in that room, and we made our way up the stone corridor and into the main building of the Chakporai. Soon I was in a room with my guide the Lama Minya donned up. Soon, happy thought, I was consuming food and feeling the better for it. "Eat well, Lobsang," said my guide, "for later in the day we shall see you again and discuss with you other matters." For an hour or so I rested in my room, looking out of the window, because I had a weakness. I always liked to look from high places and watch the world moving beneath. I loved to watch the traders wending their slow way through the western gate, their every step indicating their delight at having reached the end of a long and arduous journey through the high mountain passes. Traders in the past had told me of the wonderful view there was from a certain spot on a high pass where, as one came from the Indian border, one could look down between a cleft in the mountains and gaze upon the sacred city with its rooftops agleam with gold and, off by the side of the mountains, the white walls of the rice heap, looking indeed like a heap of rice as it sprawled in bounteous profusion down the side of the mountainous slopes. I loved to watch the ferryman crossing the happy river, and I hoped always for the sight of a puncture in his inflated hide boat. I longed to watch him gradually sink from sight until only his head protruded above the water. But I was never that fortunate. The ferryman always reached the other side, took on his load, and returned again. Soon, once more I was in that deep room with my guide, the Lama Minya donned up and the great medical lama Chinrob Nobo. "Lobsang," said the great medical lama, "you must be sure that if you are going to examine a patient in order that you may assist him or her the clothes be entirely removed." "Honorable medical lama," I said, in some confusion, "I can think of no reason why I should deprive a person of their clothing in this cold weather, for I can see their aura perfectly without there being any need whatsoever to remove a single garment, and oh, respected medical lama, how could I possibly ask a woman to remove her clothing?" My eyes rolled upwards in horror at the mere thought. I must have presented quite a comical figure, for both my guide and the medical lama burst out laughing. They sat down, and really enjoyed themselves with their laughter. I stood in front of them feeling remarkably foolish. But really, I was quite puzzled about these things. I could see an aura perfectly, with no trouble at all, and I saw no reason why I should depart from what was my own normal practice. "Lobsang," said the medical lama, "you are a very gifted clairvoyant, but there are some things which you do not yet see. We have had a remarkable demonstration from you of your ability in seeing the human aura, but you would not have seen the liver complaint of the Indian lama Mafata if he had not removed his clothing." I reflected upon this, and when I thought about it I had to admit that it was correct. I had looked at the Indian lama while he had been robed, and while I had seen much about his character and basic traits, I still had not noticed the liver complaint. "You are perfectly correct, Honorable Medical Lama," I said, "but I should like some further training from you in this matter." My guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, looked at me and said, "When you look at a person's aura, you want to see the person's aura. You are not concerned with the thoughts of the sheep whence came the wool which was made into a robe. Every aura is influenced by that which interferes with its direct rays. We have here a sheet of glass, and if I breathe upon that glass, it will affect what you see through the glass. Similarly, although this glass is transparent, it actually does alter the light, or rather the color of the light, which you would see when looking through it. In the same way, if you look through a piece of colored glass, all the vibrations which you receive from an object are altered in intensity by the action of the colored glass. Thus it is that a person whose body has upon it clothing, or ornaments of any kind, has his aura modified according to the etheric content of the clothing or ornament." I thought about it, and I had to agree that there was quite a lot in what he said. He continued, "A further point is this: every organ of the body projects its own picture, its own state of health or sickness, onto the etheric, and the aura, when uncovered and free from the influence of clothes, magnifies and intensifies the impression which one receives. Thus it is quite definite that if you are going to help a person in health or in sickness, then you will have to examine him without his clothing." He smiled at me and said, "And if the weather be cold, why then, Lobsang, you will have to take him to a warmer place." "Honorable Lama," I said, "some time ago you told me that you were working on a device which would enable one to cure illness through the aura." "That is perfectly correct, Lobsang," said my guide. "Illness is merely a dissonance in the body vibrations. An organ has its rate of molecular vibration disturbed, and so it is considered to be a sick organ. If we could actually see how much the vibration of an organ departs from the normal, then, by restoring the rate of vibration to what it should be, we have effected a cure. In the case of a mental affliction, the brain usually receives messages from the overself which it cannot correctly interpret, and so the actions resulting are those which depart from that which is accepted as normal actions for a human. Thus, if the human is not able to reason or act in a normal manner, he is said to have some mental ailment. By measuring the discrepancy, the understimulation, we can assist a person to recover normal balance. The vibrations may be lower than normal resulting in understimulation, or they may be higher than normal which would give an effect similar to that of a brain fever. Quite definitely illness can be cured by intervention through the aura." The great medical Lama interrupted here, and said, "By the way, respected colleague, the Lama Mahaphata was discussing this matter with me, and he said that at certain places in India, at certain secluded lamasaries, they were experimenting with a very high voltage device known as a," he hesitated and said, "it is a digraph generator." He was a bit uncertain about his terms, but he was making a truly manful effort to give us the exact information. This generator apparently developed an extraordinarily high voltage at an extraordinarily low current. Applied in a certain way to the body, it caused the intensity of the aura to increase many, many times, so that even the non-clairvoyant could clearly observe it. I am told also that photographs have been taken of a human aura under these conditions." My guide nodded solemnly, and said, "Yes, it is also possible to view the human aura by means of a special dye, a liquid which is sandwiched between two plates of glass. By arranging appropriate lighting and background, and viewing the nude human body through this screen, many people can indeed see the aura." I burst in and said, "But, honorable sirs, why do people have to use all these tricks? I can see the aura, why cannot they?" My two mentors laughed again. This time they did not feel it necessary to explain the difference between training such as I had had and the training of the average man or woman in the street. The medical Lama said, "Now we probe in the dark. We try to cure our patients by rule of thumb, by herbs and pills and potions. We are like blind men trying to find a pin dropped on the ground. I would like to see a small device so that any non-clairvoyant person could look through this device and see the human aura, see all the faults of the human aura, and, and seeing would be able to cure the discrepancy or the deficiency which truly was the cause of the illness. For the rest of that week I was shown things by hypnotism and by telepathy, and my powers were increased and intensified, and we had talk after talk on the best ways to see the aura and to develop a machine which would also see the aura, and then, upon the last night of that week, I went to my little room in the Chakpori Lamasery and looked out of the window thinking that on the morrow I would return again to that bigger dormitory where I slept in company with so many others. The lights in the valley were at twinkle. The last dying rays peering over the rocky rim of our valley glanced down, flicking the golden roofs as if with sparkling fingers, sending up showers of golden light, and in doing so breaking the light into iridescent colors which were of the spectrum of the gold itself. Blues and yellows and reds, and even some green struggled to attract the eye, growing dimmer and dimmer as the light faded. Soon the valley itself was as encased in dark velvet, a dark blue violet or purple velvet which could almost be felt. Through my open window I could smell the scent of the willows, and the scent of plants in the garden so far below me. A vagrant breeze wafted stronger scents to my nostrils, pollen, and budding flowers. The last dying rays of the sun sank completely out of sight, no more did those probing fingers of light come over the edge of our rock-bound valley, instead they shot off into the darkening sky, and reflected on low-lying clouds showing red and blue. Gradually the night became darker as the sun sank further and further beyond our world. Soon there were bright specks of light in the dark purple sky, the light of Saturn, of Venus, of Mars. And then came the light of the moon, hanging gibbous in the sky with all the pock marks showing plain and clear, and across the face of the moon drifted a light fleecy cloud. It reminded me of a woman drawing a garment across herself after having been examined through her aura. I turned away, resolved in every fiber of my being that I would do all I could to increase the knowledge of the human aura, and to help those who went out into the great world and brought help and ease to suffering millions. I lay down upon the stone floor, and almost as soon as my head touched my folded robe I fell asleep and knew no more. Chapter 9. The silence was profound. The air of concentration intense. At long intervals there came an almost inaudible rustle which soon subsided again into death-like quiet. I looked about me, looking at the long lines of motionless robed figures sitting erect on the floor. These were intent men, men concentrating on the doings of the outside world. Some, indeed, were more concerned with the doings of the world outside this one. My eyes roamed about, dwelling first on one august figure, and then on another. Here was a great abbot from a far-off district. There was a lama in poor and humble dress, a man come down from the mountains. Unthinkingly I moved one of the long, low tables so that I had more room. The silence was oppressive, a living silence, a silence that should not be, with so many men here. Crash! The silence was rudely and loudly shattered. I jumped a foot off the ground, in a sitting position, and somehow spun round at the same time. Sprawled out at full length, still in a daze, was a library messenger, with wooden-backed books still clattering around him. Coming in, heavily laden, he had not seen the table which I had moved. Being only 18 inches from the ground it had effectively tripped him. Now it was on top of him. Solicitor's hands gently picked up the books and dusted them off. Books are revered in Tibet. Books contain knowledge and must never be abused or mishandled. Now the thought was for the books and not for the man. I picked up the table and moved it out of the way. Wonder of wonders, no one thought that I was in any way to blame. The messenger, rubbing his head, was trying to work out what happened. I had not been near, obviously I could not have tripped him. Shaking his head in astonishment, he turned and went out. Soon calm was restored, and the lamas went back to their reading in the library. Having been damaged top and bottom, literally, while working in the kitchens, I had been permanently banished therefrom. Now, for menial work I had to go to the great library and dust the carvings on book covers and generally keep the place clean. Tibetan books are big and heavy. The wooden covers are intricately carved, giving the title and often a picture as well. It was heavy work, lifting the books from shelves, carrying them silently to my table, dusting them and then returning each book to its allotted place. The librarian was very particular, carefully examining each book to see that it really was clean. There were wooden covers which housed magazines and papers from countries outside our boundaries. I liked particularly to look at these, although I could not read a single word. Many of these months-old foreign papers had pictures, and I would pore over them whenever possible. The more the librarian tried to stop me, the more I delved into these forbidden books whenever his attention was taken from me. Pictures of wheeled vehicles fascinated me. There were, of course, no wheeled vehicles in the whole of Tibet, and our prophecies indicated most clearly that with the advent of wheels into Tibet there would be the beginning of the end. Tibet would later be invaded by an evil force which was spreading across the world like a cancerous blight. We hoped that, in spite of the prophecy, larger, more powerful nations would not be interested in our little country, which had no warlike intentions, no designs upon the living space of others. I looked at pictures, and I was fascinated. On one magazine, of course I do not know what it was called, I saw some pictures, a whole series of them, which showed the magazine being printed. There were huge machines with great rollers and immense cogwheels. Men, in the pictures, were working like maniacs, and I thought how different it was here in Tibet. Here one worked with the pride of craftsmanship, with the pride of doing a job well. No thought of commerce entered the mind of the craftsman of Tibet. I turned and looked at those pages again, and then I thought of how we were doing things. Down in the village of show books were being printed. Skilled monk carvers were carving onto fine woods Tibetan characters, carving them with the slowness which ensured absolute accuracy, absolute fidelity to minute detail. After the carvers finished each board of print, others would take that board and would polish it so that no flaw nor roughness remained on the wood. Then the board would be taken away to be inspected by others for accuracy as to text, for no mistake was ever allowed to creep into a Tibetan book. Time did not matter, accuracy did. With the boards all carved, all carefully polished and inspected for errors or flaws, it would pass to the monk printers. They would lay the board face up on a bench, and then ink would be rolled onto the raised, carved words. Of course the words were all carved in reverse, so that when printed they would appear the right way round. With the board inked and carefully inspected once again to make sure that no portion was left uninked, a sheet of stiff paper akin to the papyrus of Egypt would be quickly spread across the type with its inked surface. A smooth rolling pressure would be applied to the back of the sheet of paper, and then it would be stripped off from the printing surface in one swift movement. Monk inspectors would immediately take the page and examine it with minute care for any fault, any flaw, and if there was any flaw the paper would not be scrapped nor burned, but would be made up into bundles. The printed word, in Tibet, is held as near sacred. It is considered to be an insult to learning to destroy or mutilate paper which bears words of learning or religious words. Thus in the course of time Tibet has accumulated bundle after bundle, bale after bale, of slightly imperfect sheets. If the sheet of paper was considered satisfactorily printed, the printers were given the go-ahead and they went on producing various sheets, each one of which was as carefully examined for flaws as was the first. I often used to watch these printers at work, and in the course of my studies I had to undertake their own work myself. I carved the printed words in reverse, I smoothed the carvings after, and under meticulous supervision I inked and later printed books. Tibetan books are not bound as are Western books. A Tibetan book is a long affair, or perhaps it would be better to say it was a wide affair and very short, because a Tibetan line of print extends for several feet, but the page may be only a foot high. All the sheets containing the necessary pages would be carefully laid out, and in the fullness of time, there was no hurry, they would dry. When they had been allowed time and time again for drying, the books would be assembled. First there would be a baseboard to which they were attached to tapes, then upon the baseboard would be assembled the pages of the book in their correct order, and when each book was thus assembled, upon the pile of printed pages would be placed another heavy board which formed the cover. This heavy board would bear intricate carvings, perhaps showing scenes from the book, and of course, giving the title. The two tapes from the bottom board would now be brought up and fastened across the top board. Some considerable pressure would be exerted so that all the sheets were forced down into one compact mass. Particularly valuable books would then be carefully wrapped in silk, and the wrappings would be sealed so that only those with adequate authority could open the wrapping and disturb the piece of that so carefully printed book. It seemed to me that many of these Western pictures were of women in a remarkable state of undress. It occurred to me that these countries must be very hot countries, for how otherwise could women go about in such a scanty state? On some of the pictures people were lying down, obviously dead. While standing over them would be perhaps a villainous-looking man with a piece of metal tubing in one hand from whence issued smoke. I never could understand the purpose of this, for, to judge from my own impressions, the people of the Western world made it their chief hobby to go round and kill each other. Then big men with strange dresses on would come and put metal things on the hands, or wrists, of the person with the smoking tube. The underclad ladies did not distress me at all, nor excite any particular interest in me, for Buddhists and Hindus, and, in fact, all the peoples of the East knew well that sex was necessary in human life. It was known that sexual experience was perhaps the highest form of ecstasy which the human could experience while still in the flesh. For that reason many of our religious paintings showed a man and a woman, usually referred to as God and Goddess, in the closest of close embraces. Because the facts of life, and of birth, were so well known, there was no particular need to disguise what were facts, and so sometimes detail was almost photographic. To us this was in no way pornographic, in no way indecent, but was merely the most convenient method of indicating that with the union of male and female certain specific sensations were generated, and it was explained that with the union of souls much greater pleasure could be experienced, but that, of course, would not be upon this world. From talks with traders in the city of Lhasa, in the village of Sho, and those who rested by the wayside at the Western Gate, I gathered the amazing information that in the Western world it was considered indecent to expose one's body to the gaze of another. I could not understand why this should be so, for the most elementary fact of life was that there had to be two sexes. I remembered a conversation with an old trader who frequented the route between Kalimpong in India and Lhasa. Throughout some considerable time I had made it my business to meet him at the Western Gate, and to greet him at one more successful visit to our land. Often we would stand and chat for quite a while. I would give him news about Lhasa and he would give me news about the great world outside. Often, too, he would bring books and magazines for my guide the Lama Miniadondup, and I would then have the pleasant task of delivering them. This particular trader once said to me, "I have told you much about the people of the West, but I still do not understand them. One of their sayings in particular just does not make sense to me. It is this: man is made in the image of God, they say, and yet they are afraid to show their body which they claim is made in the image of God. Does it mean, then, that they are ashamed of God's form?" He would look at me questioningly, and I of course was quite at a loss. I just could not answer his question. Man is made in the image of God. Therefore, if God is the ultimate in perfection, as should be the case, there should be no shame in exposing an image of God. We so-called heathens were not ashamed of our bodies. We knew that without sex there would be no continuation of the race. We knew that sex, on appropriate occasions, and in appropriate surroundings of course, increased the spirituality of a man and of a woman. I was also astounded when I was told that some men and women who had been married, perhaps for years, had never seen the unclad body of the other. When I was told that they made love only with the blinds down and the light out, I recall I thought my informant was taking me for a country bumpkin who really was too foolish to know what was going on in the world, and after one such session I decided that at the first opportunity I'd ask my guide, the Lama Miniadondup, about sex in the Western world. I turned away from the Western Gate, and dashed across the road to the narrow, dangerous path which we boys of Chakpura used in preference to the regular path. This path would have frightened a mountaineer, frequently it frightened us as well, but it was a point of honor not to use the other path unless we were in company with our seniors and, presumably, betters. The mode of progression upwards entailed climbing by hand up jagged tufts of rock, dangling precariously from certain exposed roots, and at all times doing those things which no presumably sane person would do if they were paid a fortune. Eventually I reached the top, and got into the Chakpori by a route which was also known to us and which would have given the proctors fits if they too had known. So, at last I stood within the inner courtyard far more exhausted than if I had come up the orthodox path, but at least honor was satisfied. I had done the trip up somewhat faster than some of the boys did it down. I shook the dust and small stones out of my robe, and emptied my bowl which had collected numerous small plants, and then feeling fairly presentable I wended my way inwards in search of my guide. The Lama Minya dawned up. As I rounded a corner I saw him proceeding away from me and so I called, "Ow! Honorable Lama!" He stopped, and turned and walked towards me, an action which possibly no other man in Chakpori would have done, for he treated every man and boy as equal, as he used to say, "It is not the outward form, it is not the body which one is at present wearing but what is inside, what is controlling the body, that counts." My guide himself was a great incarnation who easily had been recognized on his return to body. It was an always remembered lesson for me that this great man was humble and always considered the feelings of those who were not merely not so great, but some who were, to put it bluntly, downright low. "Well now Lobsang," said my guide, "I saw you coming up that forbidden path, and if I had been a proctor you would have been smarting in quite a number of places now. You would have been glad to remain standing for many hours." He laughed, and said, "However, I used to do substantially the same thing myself, and I still get what is possibly a forbidden thrill in seeing others do what I can no longer do. Well, what is the rush anyhow?" I looked up at him and said, "Honorable Lama, I have been hearing horrible things about the people of the Western world and my mind is indeed in a constant turmoil, for I am unable to tell if I am being laughed at, if I am being made to look a worse fool than usual, or whether the marvels which have been described to me are indeed fact." "Come with me, Lobsang," said my guide, "I am just going to my room, I was going to meditate but let us discuss things instead." "Meditation can wait." We turned and walked along side by side to the Lama Minya Donup's room, the one which overlooked the jewel park. I entered the room in his footsteps, and instead of immediately sitting down, he rang for the attendant to bring us tea. Then, with me by his side, he moved across to the window and looked out across that lovely expanse of land. Land which was one of the most beautiful places perhaps in the whole world. Below us, slightly to our left, was the fertile wooded garden known as the Norbulinga or Jewel Park. The beautiful clear water sparkled among the trees, and the inmost one small temple set upon an island was gleaming in the sunlight. Someone was crossing the rocky causeway, a path across the water made of flat stones with spaces between so that the water could flow free and the fish would have no bar. I looked carefully and thought I could distinguish one of the high members of the government. "Yes, Lobsang, he is going to see the inmost one," said my guide in answer to my unspoken thought. Together we watched for some time, for it was pleasant here looking out upon that park with, beyond it, the happy river sparkling and dancing as if with the joy of a beautiful day. We could also see down by the ferry, one of my favorite spots. It was a never-ending source of pleasure and amazement to me to see the ferryman get on his inflated skin boat and paddle away merrily to the other side. Below us, between us and the Norbulinga, pilgrims were making their slow way along the Lingkor road. They went along giving hardly a glance to our own Chakpori but keeping a constant lookout to see if possibly they could see anything of interest from the jewel park, for it must have been common knowledge to the ever-alert pilgrims that the inmost one would be at the Norbulinga. I could see too the Kashailinga, a little park, well wooded, which was by the side of the ferry road. There was a small road leading from the Lingkor road down to the Kaiichu, and it was used mainly by travelers who wanted to use the ferry. Some, however, used it to reach the Lama's garden which was on the other side of the ferry road. The attendant brought in tea for us and pleasant food as well. My guide, The Lama Minyadon Up said, "Come, Lobsang, let us break our fast, for men who are going to debate must not be empty inside unless their head soap proves to be empty."